From Mississippi to New York, Kansas to South Carolina, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Biden administration is pushing the G7 nations to unite in adopting a minimum global corporate tax rate. Christine McDaniel from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University is here to explain. U.S. Senator Joe Manchin has scuttled plans by Democrats to end the Senate filibuster. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story on the impact. Lumber prices have gone through the roof, and a Biden administration plan to enact tariffs could make wood products even more expensive. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine has details. And millions of jobs are going unfilled because federal unemployment benefits are keeping workers on the sidelines. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. It is known as the minimum global corporate tax rate, and it is designed to keep companies from relocating to countries with lower taxes. It is something the G7 group of nations is considering. Christine McDaniel is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. She is here to explain the tax and the ramifications. Christine, welcome to American Radio Journal. Christine, before we get to details of the minimum global corporate tax, tell us, first of all, what is the G7, which is where this issue appeared, and also tell us what the tax is.
The G7 is the group of seven countries, and it's an organization made up of basically the world's seven largest so-called advanced economies. So those include the United States, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and the UK. Russia actually joined in the late 90s, and then it was called the G8, but then they were kicked out for taking over Crimea. So now we're back to the G7. And in terms of your second question, what is this global corporate minimum tax people are talking about? So this is a proposal by Treasury Secretary Yellen that, frankly, has been a long time coming. But the idea is the agreement would create a minimum tax on profits that companies earn by selling services, mainly advertising, but that don't have a physical presence in the country.
Looking at that sort of a tax, then, it sort of globalizes the tax rate then, Christine. Does this not then put the United States at a disadvantage? For example, if we're able to have a lower tax in other countries, doesn't that advantage our businesses?
Well, actually, the U.S. would probably be one of the countries that would benefit from this. So while it's kind of about, in some ways, this is about fairness, you know, so you and I, at least that's how Secretary Yellen and her colleagues are often describe it. So you and I, you know, we pay taxes based on where we live, but globetrotting multinational corporations really can locate the legal presence of their profits wherever they want to. So, you know, like the Cayman Islands or Luxembourg, the places that have been using very low rates, sometimes near zero tax rates, to lure companies like workers and in their investment. So the idea of a 15% minimum tax would just discourage companies from moving that offshore. And this is, the OECD is saying that this would basically apply to the quote unquote largest and most profitable multinational companies. So it doesn't single out big U.S. tech giants, but it does apply to the largest and most profitable ones. And so, yes, that does include Apple, Facebook, Google, Amazon. Google profits from a lot from advertising. Apple profits from its app store. Facebook also profits from advertising. And these companies have been battling a digital tax or plans for a digital tax in an increasing number of countries around the world, France, Spain, Italy, the UK, just to name a few. And now the U.S. Trade Representative, Ms. Catherine Tai, has recently threatened response to those digital taxes in terms of sanctions. And the U.S. threatening sanctions in response to those countries that tax American tech giants on their digital profits, on their turf, you could see where this would lead, right? This could lead to a global trade war that would frankly make the past few years look like a cakewalk. And so this is, I think, been in the works for a long time. And the OECD has been meeting about this for many, many years with no large agreement. But once a number of countries started going ahead with a digital tax, it became clear that a broader agreement was necessary.
So the G7 is proposing this minimum global corporate tax or digital tax. Does it now have to be something that is approved by Congress, and then the other six nations involved, do they have an internal process as well?
Yes. If this global minimum corporate tax goes through, then, or if it's agreed upon, at least in principle, for it to be implemented, then, right, all participating countries would have to enact, you know, their own domestic laws. So, and that's a big question mark. Most countries in the G7 have been quite supportive of this. But then moving past the G7 to the G20, the group of 20, many more countries, not all of them have been so supportive. So, for instance, Ireland, you know, they've been very open about their concern. They're at about 12.5%, so they would, you know, 15% is definitely higher for them. But then some in Congress don't like it. It's unclear if other countries are going to move ahead until they see the U.S. move first.
Not only do we have the G7 and the G20 and other more developed, more wealthy economies moving somewhat toward this, and there being somewhat of disagreement, as you've pointed out, what impact would this have on poor countries, on developing countries? Would it impact potential businesses they could develop in underdeveloped areas?
That's a good question. I don't know if there's been a lot of comprehensive thinking about that yet. Just intuition would suggest that it would have very little effect on developing countries because, you know, we're not talking about Starbucks or Amazon setting up headquarters in, you know, Ethiopia in order to avoid paying U.S., you know, U.S. corporate tax rate. We're talking about these large multinational companies investing in a headquarters in a low tax jurisdiction that still has the infrastructure to support those financial transactions. So, The poorest countries, I think, would be unlikely to be affected at all. The advanced economies probably stand to gain the most, right? Because most big U.S. companies, they probably won't want to go through the trouble of creating these shell companies offshore if it won't save them as much in taxes. So the hope is that we'll keep more business in the U.S., maybe be able to collect more corporate taxes, even though other countries will also be able to get some of those benefits. But when the digital tax surfaced a couple of years ago, a lot of large international tax experts were saying, well, those revenues are ours to tax. And just because we don't want to tax them doesn't mean you, Europe, can tax them, right? And so that ruffled a lot of feathers. And then thinking evolved. And then obviously we kept seeing all these countries move ahead with their digital tax. And then it was kind of like, okay, we get it. This is not working for everyone. How about we do this? So 15% is fairly low. It's not going to be binding for advanced economies, but it will disincentivize big companies from spending extra money to set up shell companies when it won't save them as much in the first place. So if anything, the U.S. and other advanced economies would probably stand to gain, while, say, the Cayman Islands or Luxembourg or maybe Ireland, those low-tax jurisdictions, even Cyprus, those low-tax jurisdictions would stand to lose.
We have been talking with Christine McDaniel, who is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center, which, of course, is at George Mason University. Christine, tell us just a little bit about the Mercatus Center and where can folks go on the web to learn more?
So Mercatus is Latin for market, M-E-R-C-A-T-U-S. And we're basically a research institute inside George Mason University. And we work to try to bridge the gap between academic research and policymakers to educate policymakers about the trade-offs of different policies that they have to decide on. We really like to focus on market-based solutions and demonstrate, you know, all the economic benefits and costs of different policy choices that Congress can make.
And your website would be?
www.mercatus.org.
Christine McDaniel of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Christine, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, sir.
Scott Parkinson joining us from the offices of the Club for Growth, where he's keeping an eye on a very busy Washington, D.C. these days. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
Let's start out talking about West Virginia, where, for a small state, West Virginia's two U.S. senators are playing a central role, a pivotal role, if you will, these days. Most notably, Joe Manchin, who, given the fact the Senate is split 50-50, he's a Democrat, is carrying enormous weight. He, this past week, announced that he wouldn't support ending the filibuster and also a couple of other major pieces of legislation that the Democrats are pushing that he's not on. Can you fill us in on that?
With a 50-50 Senate, really any senator has the ability to flex their legislative weight if they so choose to do that. The issue here with the For the People Act, also known as the Corrupt Politicians Act, is that Joe Manchin is really one of the only senators that wasn't a co-sponsor. And so while he held out his support for that legislation, there were a couple of other senators that are still on the fence on what to do with the filibuster itself and whether or not to abolish the legislative filibuster, changing the threshold for final passage and ending debate from 60 votes down to a simple majority. And so we saw Joe Manchin come out with a pretty forceful opinion editorial in his home state of West Virginia this weekend. And Joe Manchin is obviously drawing a red line here about bipartisanship in the United States Senate. His problem, ultimately, with the way that H.R. 1 and S. 1, that big voting rights bill, which basically codifies the 2020 election in terms of mail-in ballots and access to elections with drop places, et cetera, he thinks that that's too partisan moving forward to really change the process that the Senate considers legislation. And he also reminds senators that just a couple of years ago when Republicans held all the keys to the House, Senate, and White House, 33 Senate Democrats joined together in opposing abolishing the filibuster. So now he might be the only one hanging out on the vine that's willing to stand tough against Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and the Squad and a new presidency with Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. But I think that all in all, Joe Manchin is coming from a position of principle based on the process, not just on the policy for this one bill. Joe Manchin is interested in still passing civil rights legislation related to voting rights. They're going to call that the John Lewis Civil Rights Act. That's H.R. 4. And I would expect that to be a hot topic of legislation later this fall.
And also, I think it can be said that Joe Manchin is reflecting his constituency in West Virginia, which, as you know, has tilted heavily to the Republican side in presidential races in recent years. The other U.S. senator from West Virginia, Shelley Moore Capito, has been playing a major role here, Scott, in negotiating with President Biden on this so-called infrastructure bill. Can you fill us in on the latest developments there?
We've had multiple weeks of intense negotiations between Shelley Moore Capito, the Republican from West Virginia, dealing directly and negotiating directly multiple times with President Biden on these infrastructure negotiations. And what happened this week was they basically hit a standstill and Joe Biden dumped her from the negotiations. And there's a new sheriff in town when it comes to negotiating on behalf of the Republicans. Joe Biden is now negotiating with a Republican senator from Louisiana named Bill Cassidy. And so you kind of look into the nuances and the details of why those negotiations fell apart. And ultimately, it comes to how much money people are willing to spend. How much new money are they willing to put forward? Republicans and Joe Biden were way apart by almost $2 trillion on the front end. And then Republicans started to put forward what they would call new money, money that was above the baseline of discretionary spending on transportation projects and infrastructure projects, and that would be additional stimulus. And so the Democrats want to have huge, huge total. I think still about the $1.5 trillion mark is where they're at. And with Cassidy now at the table instead of Shelley Moore Capito, Democrats are optimistic that they'll be able to get some Republicans to work with them.
And also, speaking of U.S. senators, we do have elections next year where a third of the United States Senate will be up for re-election. As you mentioned earlier, the Senate is split 50-50. with 50 Republicans and actually 48 Democrats and two independents who caucus with the Democrats, but a huge, major race in the state of North Carolina and a big development in that race this past week. Tell us about that.
Last weekend, President Trump endorsed U.S. Representative Ted Budd for the United States Senate in North Carolina. This was a big deal because on the ballot, there's two other pretty credible Republican candidates. One is a former Representative Mark Walker, and then you also have former Governor Pat McCrory, who ran three times for statewide office and lost twice, won once. And so Donald Trump came in, and he gave a big rally before the North Carolina Republican Party. And during that rally, Laura Trump officially declared that she will not be a candidate in 2022 for the United States Senate. And moments later, Donald Trump gave his complete and total endorsement to Congressman Ted Budd. And so that's a big deal. That's a race that the Club for Growth PAC has already been involved in. We announced our endorsement of Ted Budd a little bit over a month ago, and we're excited for his candidacy, and obviously that'll be a very, very competitive race when it comes to not just the primary, but the general election. And so we are all in together with President Trump to ensure that that state stays red.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, we always like to end by telling our listeners a little bit about the club and also how they can get in touch with you.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We have a 501c4 that's based on issue advocacy, and we have a political action committee and a super PAC that are related to campaigns. So today we talked a little bit about the issue advocacy on election integrity and voting legislation on Capitol Hill and those infrastructure packages. And then we also talked about the political arm with the endorsement of Congressman Budd. So if your listeners want to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at clubforgrowth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. As always, Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
If you have tried to buy wood lately, you know the price has skyrocketed, and potential tariffs being considered by the Biden administration could drive costs even higher. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains.
If you've gone to purchase lumber within the past few months for your garden or for new bookshelves, maybe a kid's treehouse in the backyard, you may have found yourself paying through the nose for those materials or maybe putting off the work in the hopes that prices would fall in the future. It's even worse if you're waiting for a new home because expensive lumber is adding tens of thousands of dollars to the price of building the average house. And much of the pain is already being caused by various government policies, but the Biden administration is about to maybe make things worse. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. Today, we're taking a look at these surging lumber prices that are adding, as I said, an average of $36,000 to the construction cost of a new home. And amid these all-time high lumber prices, the Biden administration is now moving forward with plans to double tariffs on lumber imported from Canada. Yes, the Commerce Department just a few weeks ago announced that it was taking the first step towards hiking so-called anti-dumping tariffs on Canadian lumber from an average rate of about 9% up to 18.5%. If approved through what's likely to be a weeks-long review process, those tariffs would actually apply retroactively to purchases made even in the past 2 years. That means that importers would be on the hook for potentially millions of dollars in import taxes that they didn't even know that they would have to pay, taxes that would end up likely being passed down the supply chain in the form of yet higher prices. And that's really only the first bit of insanity here, because anti-dumping tariffs, in theory, are meant to cancel out what's seen as unfair subsidies for foreign competitors to American companies. They're supposed to be deployed in order to prevent import prices from becoming so low that they threaten domestic producers, even though there's, you know, really nothing terrible about paying low prices for wood or anything else. But lumber prices right now are anything but low. In fact, they're 250% higher than they were just a year ago, and the price per 1,000 feet of board lumber just hit an all-time high. If the Biden administration goes ahead with this plan to hike tariffs, it will be the latest bit of industrial protectionism emanating from Washington that will be paid for by Americans. While the domestic timber and lumber industries are understandably thrilled at the prospect of artificially inflated prices for imports from Canada, which is the largest foreign supplier by far of wood into the United States, those higher tariffs will almost certainly translate into higher prices for consumers and for any industry that uses wood. The current price surge for lumber, like similar increases for many other goods, to be fair, has been triggered by a shortage of supply as the pandemic-closed sawmills have been slow to reopen, even while demand for lumber has steadily climbed, driven by robust demand for new housing. Import taxes aren't to blame entirely for the high prices that we're seeing right now, but raising those import taxes, raising those tariffs, certainly won't be helping the situation. And even the Trump administration, which counterproductively hiked tariffs on a wide range of goods from steel and aluminum to washing machines and other consumer items, realized that the tariffs on lumber really weren't working. Trump approved a lumber tariff hike in 2017, but then his administration actually cut those tariffs in late 2020 amid growing concerns about the rising price of lumber. High and rising lumber prices aren't just a problem for home builders and others who need to buy large supplies of wood. Some manufacturers are also concerned that tariffs are helping to drive inflation across the entire economy. But Biden's plan now boils down to basically saying that in the middle of these soaring prices and short supply of lumber in the United States, the federal government should choke off other sources of the stuff that might fill that demand and help bring down prices. In fact, it's easy to see the U.S. government's mistreatment of the market for lumber, not just in the industry itself, but because of the fact that the impact falls so heavily on consumers. It's a horrifying example of how officialdom's overall economic incompetence filters through the rest of the economy. Through poor financial policy, the government reduced the number of domestic lumber suppliers. With tariffs, it raised the price of imported lumber for American consumers, further restricting options. And governments have also imposed pandemic measures that have hobbled many sectors of the economy, including sawmills, some of which were required to close or operate at lower capacity. The federal government has also offered expanded unemployment benefits, which is incentivizing people not to take jobs, and that in turn makes it difficult to expand production and virtually impossible to bring some of the semi-closed sawmills back to full capacity. And now the Biden administration just wants to double down on all that by hiking these tariffs even further. What government officials and these ill-considered policies have done to the lumber industry is just mind-bogglingly stupid, but unfortunately, the results of government mistreatment of the lumber market go beyond stupidity to impose massive expenses, as any home handyman or building contractor could tell you right now. Lumber prices will eventually come down again, maybe sometime in 2022 as supply catches up to demand, but not until much of the public is paying a high cost as the result of these policy mistakes. When government officials fumble around with things they don't understand while pretending they're making improvements, they often leave the rest of us to pick up the tab. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our coverage of everything in the news this week at Reason.com, and you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
With unemployment benefits supplemented by pandemic relief funds, many workers are staying out of the workforce, and this has created a worker shortage. So says Jonathan Williams on this American Radio Journal commentary.
America faces a jobs crisis. Expanded unemployment payments, such as the bonus $300 per week benefits authorized by the Federal American Rescue Plan, or ARPA, legislation, encourage people not to work, thereby slowing our American economic recovery. In many situations, it is possible for individuals to collect more on unemployment benefits than the wages they will earn if they were returned to the workforce. Economists across the ideological spectrum, from Casey Mulligan and Stephen Moore on the right to Lawrence Summers on the left, have warned us about unforced errors with unemployment-related policies. This should be a key lesson for all of us to remember from Economics 101. When you tax people who work and pay people who do not work, no one should be surprised when you have fewer people looking to work. New data just this week from the Bureau of Labor Statistics revealed the number of job openings across America just reached a staggering 9.3 million, a record number since the Bureau started reporting this information back in the year 2000. Additionally, the National Federation of Independent Business, NFIB, released its monthly Small Business Optimism Index. While optimism has increased since January, a record 48% of business owners across the country reported job openings that they could not fill. Even with small businesses increasing compensation, it is difficult, if not impossible, for them to compete with the federal government's printing presses, which continue financing the bonus unemployment payments. Recently, states have started to address this problem. Governor Greg Gianforte of Montana and Governor Henry McMaster of South Carolina led the way, stating that their two respective states would end participation in a range of federal programs created under the CARES Act last year and extended under ARPA, including the $300 per week unemployment benefits authorized by ARPA. Now, 25 states have announced that they will stop giving expanded unemployment payments over the summer, with many states ending payments as early as this month. A new report for the Foundation of Government Accountability uncovered some fascinating information. As the first 22 states announced their withdrawal from the unemployment bonus payments, job applicants actually immediately increased by 5%. Incredible. Last year, after the economic downturn, state unemployment insurance trust funds were predictably under immense stress. In an annual report on the UI trust fund solvency released in March, the Department of Labor found that 37 states fell below the minimum level required to meet the quote-unquote adequate solvency. In May, the Department of the Treasury released a statement providing guidance on the use of the $350 billion in the coronavirus state and local fiscal recovery funds from the ARPA legislation. Treasury clarified, thankfully, that the federal funds can be used to replenish the state unemployment insurance trust funds back to pre-pandemic levels if state policymakers choose to use those resources. And if they choose to use that option, states will avoid damaging tax increases levied on employers who pay state taxes into their respective UI state trust funds. Yet another complicating factor to the stability of state unemployment systems is widespread improper payments and actual criminal fraud. On top of the millions of people put out of work last year, the United States Department of Justice found that international organized criminal groups often use stolen identities for fraudulent UI benefits. Recent reports show that billions in unemployment benefits last year were spent on falsified claims, straining state UI trust funds even more and diverting those important resources away from those truly in need. The best way forward for states to solve these unemployment insurance issues is to remove disincentives for people to get back to work. They can follow the examples of Montana and South Carolina and the states that followed their lead. As people get back into the workforce, state and federal policymakers must seriously consider unemployment insurance reform that will help those who truly need it, who lose their jobs, but also prevent future fraud. These efforts will protect financial solvency in the states and, more importantly, protect hardworking individual taxpayers and employers. I'm Jonathan Williams for American Radio Journal. For more information, go to alec.org.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WWFA-AM in Florence, Alabama, along with KHII-FM and KTMN-FM in Alamogordo, New Mexico. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.